We are talking with Scott Onstott about taking measure explorations in number, architecture, and consciousness. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us here in the second hour. Really appreciate you being with us here. I wanted to ask you, Scott, a little bit about origins. I read in your book that you say, I mean, you make the obvious connection that a lot of this goes back to Egypt, but one of the main reasons for this might actually just be how the climate has been down there. Hence, we have still preservation fairly well, while there are other many prehistorical civilizations that might be equally responsible for the knowledge that we do see. Ancient Sumer, there is a connection to, you know, old Europe and you know, it's India, China, it goes all over the world. And it's always just interesting to hear what people what they think about it, rather, because we don't know yet. But where does it go back to? Is it a single point or?
Well, I have kind of two minds about that. The first perspective is that there's evidence. I think Graham Hancock is the real champion of this. That there was an ancient civilization that came before a great cataclysm. Let's call it Atlantis. And after the cataclysm, much of that civilization was destroyed in the rising seawater, rising sea level. And we only have traces of it. So perhaps this ancient civilization had great wisdom, and the remnants of that, the survivors, were able to build things, let's say, like the Great Pyramid and Stonehenge, and they encoded great wisdom. And they didn't have enough people left to maintain their culture, so their knowledge died out. And then we were left with Neolithic tribespeople who were ignorant of all of those things. And it took us, you know, 12,000 years to get to where we are now, and we're sort of uncovering some of that information. So that's, let's call that perspective one. Perspective two is that perhaps the ancient Egyptians have encoded all of these amazing things in the Great Pyramid, for example. But I don't want to be victim of something Ken Wilber calls the pre-trans fallacy, that is, assigning a rationality to a culture that was pre-rational. So what would be the mechanism then for the ancient Egyptians to know all of the detailed scientific information they would have needed to know to encode these things in the Great Pyramid? Mm-hmm. Well, I think that one possibility is that they were, in those days, like Rudolf Steiner would say, they were more in communion with the gods. The veil between the physical and the astral, if you will, was thinner then.
Exactly.
And so the Egyptians were not rational, but they were living in a world of myths and symbol, and the beings in this other realm were their parents in a way, their guides, their mentors, and they directed the people to build the Great Pyramid just as it is, and it was their wisdom that was transmitted to the ancient Egyptians. This is also a very intriguing possibility. So if you choose possibility one, you can stay a scientific materialist, but then you have to believe in Atlantis, which is quite a stretch for most people. Mm-hmm. But I think that people like Randall Carlson and Graham Hancock provide excellent research that shows that this is a viable possibility. That this geologically could have happened, that perhaps cyclical catastrophes do occur, and perhaps we've had civilization on Earth many times, but it's been wiped out such that there's almost no trace of it. Hmm. And this reminds me of a YouTube video I saw just 2 days ago of a young woman who was looking on Google Earth, and she discovered a few pyramids in Egypt in the middle of the desert, just north of a lake there. And they went there on the ground and checked it out, and they used ground penetrating radar, and they found there's cavities there, and there's gold, presence of metals under the pyramid. And these pyramids are extremely eroded. They look like these ordered sand mounds, more or less. And it's evidence that this was underwater.
Yeah.
And one of them is bigger than the Great Pyramid.
Oh, really?
And so perhaps, you know, there was an ancient civilization that was largely wiped out. And just the stragglers built the Great Pyramid, you know, the survivors, who the few people who actually lived through that cataclysm.
Yeah.
I find that intriguing. But I think the truth is probably more of a synthesis of those two viewpoints, where we may have had an ancient civilization that passed down knowledge, but at the same time, the consciousness was certainly different in that ancient period. And it was the time of gods and people. That's where all of our mythology comes from. People largely didn't have rationality until, say, the Greeks came along. That was a kind of a new way of being then.
Scott,
I don't want to go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt, but do you believe that we have changed over time, our makeup, maybe even our brains, that have enabled this? Because if we look at it still to this day, everyone is not born rational. Obviously, this is something that we have to awaken in us, and you know, with learning how to use our you know, brain, etc. So, do you think that we still have, you know, we're kind of in the twilight zone, maybe between both worlds right now, and we're slowly going in one direction, or how do you view it?
Well, I like the map that Ken Wilber has laid out in regards to the evolution of form. The point is that it is evolving, that it is transcending and including earlier stages of itself. And rationality is just one of the stages of human development. And I think Ken Wilber uses the research of Gene Gebser, and also he uses some spiral dynamics. And the concept here is that our consciousness evolves through stages. We start with an instinctual level, we go up through a magical level, and then perhaps a tribal power level, where there's a headman who, you know, rules with a sense of egocentrism, and then that goes into a consciousness of mythological conformity
mm-hmm.
to the tribe. And then only after that sort of fundamentalist level, then the next stage is rationality. And so Western culture went through that with the Enlightenment most recently, although that has flowered before, as I said, in ancient Greece.
Right.
And then beyond that, it moved into postmodernism or post-rational, a stage which transcends and includes rationality, which was sort of spearheaded in the 1960s with a sensitivity that was brought in, a recognition of diversity and honoring differences. And then beyond that, the last or the next level would be a huge one, and that is an integral level that includes all of those different perspectives of development. So I think it's only when you get to that next stage, that integral level, can you look back at where you've been and value the perspectives that you've had as being valid and useful for you as you were developing. Now, when I was a preteen, I was a born-again Christian, and I was my father was involved in the Christian church, and that sort of became my world for that time. But when I became a teenager, rationality sort of replaced that
mm-hmm.
in my development.
Right.
And then in college, it was sort of this package of rationality and atheism.
the polar opposite, you know, and you, yeah.
Yeah, studying engineering and architecture. And so that you know, I evolved to that. And then later I recognize in my own life history that I went through a shift into this kind of postmodern viewpoint, and that brought in all sort of the green sensitivity, the feeling, the respect for all cultures. And then only very recently, in the last few years, do I recognize a shift to this integral level in myself, where then I can look back and not reject my past and say, oh, I was wrong when I was a fundamentalist Christian. That's not true at all. It's a beautiful stage and one we should honor and try to make it healthy. At least that's how I view it now. I spent quite a long time poring over the works of Ken Wilber, who's really an excellent, I would call him a map maker. So he has this great explanation of how consciousness evolves, and I find that very compelling.
Yeah.
But it again, it's just a map. It's not the reality. So you can take it or leave it. Hmm. But I find it a useful map.
Very interesting. Yeah. I agree with you. I think it's as all things are, as we go through different stages, I think that we go through them for, just as you explained, various reasons. But I think it's what the most important thing is when we begin to understand that they both are necessary, but also that we can lend and use from all of them. It's about balancing the different stages that we've gone through to be complete. Otherwise, I see so many people suggest they just operate in a counteractive mode. They might have been one way and one stage, and then they just go the polar opposite and think that they have the solution or the key to how to be, as a human being, when it's about accepting all those stages, as you say, and try to become complete and whole with all the things that you've gone through, and then look forward to even go beyond that.
Exactly, Henrik. I think you're expressing the viewpoint of someone who's at an integral level, who's looking back at the landscape of where you've been personally and where other people are, and you respect all of that, and you see it as wonderful. But correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe when you were younger, you could remember thinking that your way of viewing the world was really the only way that was valid. At least for me, that's I remember going through stages of being very black and white, or very judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have sympathy with people who are that way to a point, but I see it as just a natural unfoldment of consciousness. These are not idiosyncratic things. These are universal structures that we all move through.
Yeah.
And so when you can see that, there's a respect that comes for that process and a honoring of it, I think, that is important.
Where do you think we're going, Scott, as a species, if we get a little bit more philosophical here, and the progression that we've been through so far? Where do you see that going in the future? Where are we heading?
I think ultimately we're headed to a recognition that there is only one awareness that shines through us all. But on that road, we have all of the different stages of consciousness, because we all have to start at square one when we're born. And so the question is, you can look at our cultures and sort of ascertain the personality of that culture, and that's really influential in molding people. And I found that, I noticed that when I recently traveled to Europe and I went to Italy and France, I noticed how much people seem to be a product of their culture. And then that gave me pause to reflect upon my own culture and how much I'm influenced by that culture. So what's important is that the cultures evolve and move forward. And then as that happens, it sort of drags the critical mass of people, or the center of gravity of people is likewise sort of moved forward in general, so that largely in the world, in cities today, we have more and more people going up to this sensitive postmodern level. And I find that really encouraging because it's allowing more perspective. Each stage allows you to embrace more and more perspectives, to hold contradiction more comfortably in your being.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a sign of an intelligence, of being able to see things through other people's eyes, is a solution to conflict. So where we see these major wars and conflicts, we have work to do there in terms of trying to let people see the world through their enemy's eyes, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Well,
it's when it becomes that black and white, then that's where it becomes dangerous, because it gets so polarized that you do not have any understanding. That's when you justify in whatever way you can to, you know, the murder of others, the killing of others, just because they're, you know, not us or they're different. And I too, Scott, see this in it. I can apply this to so many different level that I even see, and this might, you know, be a stretch beyond what we're talking about here, but even in terms of people who believe that they have attained a higher level or that they're more intelligent or more, you know, open-minded or progressive, what have you, but there is still a same level of black and whiteness, if you will, in their attitudes towards others who they do not agree with. And so yet there's tolerance on one level being proposed, you know, as a proponent of tolerance, but then it still is not applicable. Do you see what I'm getting at, Scott?
Yeah, that might be identified in this map as unhealthy green. It's people that are at this sensitive level where they speak about embracing diversity, but then they think that they're the only ones that are right.
Yeah.
And that their viewpoint is the most evolved.
That's right.
And there's a big problem with that exclusivity itself, because that divides. Necessarily, it causes conflict. So until people can value everyone else's viewpoint, we're going to have problems. But these are natural growing pains. These are
sure.
Just like the development of a person through their childhood. Our cultures are like that on it, but at a different scale.
Well, brothers and sisters, you know, or brothers are fighting when they're young, you know, cubs are having at it. It's, I mean, it might be brutal and ferocious and horrible in some cases, but if we zoom out and look at the bigger picture, I don't see any difference. It's all training wheels, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that when we do get a critical mass of humanity up to an integral level, I think that will be the day when the aliens, if you will welcome us, because we'll be welcomed into a larger civilization which encompasses many worlds. This is a possibility I find intriguing, and perhaps that's influenced because last night I watched a Star Trek film called First Contact, where it was that was the theme.
I remember it. Yeah, I watched it recently too, with the Borg and the Vulcans coming out and all that. You know, yeah.
Yeah, like it's like it wasn't until we got warp drive that we were then welcomed into the larger reality.
Right. Yeah.
So what I think is that it's not warp drive, but it's recognizing that everyone else is us. So there's no reason for killing them, you know.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to go, and it only makes sense from the separate self's perspective, right? So, but we're always going to have that perspective. We can't get rid of it. It's part of human growth from an infant. You have to grow the separate self, but you have to go through all of these stages to transcend it.
Yeah.
So I think that ultimately, and this may take hundreds or thousands of years, we'll get the bulk of humanity up to a point where they transcend their personal ego. They also transcend their ethnicity, and they transcend the world. Then they can be cosmos-centric beings. And so I think this is written into the architecture of the universe. It's our destiny. We're going there. But where we are now is sort of at a much earlier stage. We're at a point where we do have these internecine rivalries, and we're killing each other, and we're fighting over resources, and we're, you know, we have all this drama, but without the drama, we don't evolve. So, in a way, everything is perfect from that highest perspective. Mm. Of course, I don't always stay there in that perspective. I can, you know, I can be very angry, and I can have all kinds of problems. But I aspire to transcending those limitations and seeing the commonalities among people. Yeah. And I found that creating Secrets in Plain Sight was a wonderful practice for me. It was a transformative, and it continues to be a transformative hobby or vocation or passion.
Mm-hmm.
Of mine to recognize all these patterns that I perceive and to express them with whatever talents I have to the best of my ability. And I find that very fulfilling, that process. And I am looking forward to more of this exploration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, very good, Scott. I wanted to, speaking of others, you mentioned aliens, but also other existences, or other entities, rather, it's a better word, I would guess. Tell us a little bit more about the different encoders that you do talk about in the book. You gave us a little hint in the first hour there, but let's get into the different levels, how you see that this is kind of divided, if you will, and who's doing what here.
Okay, so I broke it down into four types. Encoders of the first kind are humans involved in conspiracy. And the most likely candidates for that are architects, or I should say the ones that I'm looking at, because I have a background in architecture, and so it was natural for me to study architecture around the world. And I notice all of these patterns and alignments and distances and so on. And this is my first thought, that there must be there's clearly something going on here. Who knows about it? It's a conspiracy of people. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the first kind. Encoders of the second kind are physical extraterrestrial beings that may come here in craft. And, you know, I read the works of Zechariah Sitchin, who, you know, many people have debunked, but nevertheless, I find it a compelling story. I took it for what it is, a story. And I recognize sort of a seed of truth in it, that perhaps our DNA has been engineered in the distant past. It is really weird. The human animal is very odd compared to our chimpanzees, for example. You know?
Yeah.
Do you consider yourself to be 99% chimpanzee?
No.
No. But our DNA, I think it's 98 or 99% the same as chimpanzees.
So they say, yeah.
But we are so different. But where did that come from? Was that a more advanced being who altered our DNA? I find that a very compelling possibility.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let me ask you this before we carry on there. Beyond potentially being involved in manipulation of creating the human being genetically and everything else, is there other examples of what the second kind here of the encoders might have done on the planet? Would this mean that they might also have been responsible for certain monuments, let's say, that have encoded some of these measurements in them?
Definitely. I think Stephen Greer has pointed out, you know, with the Disclosure Project, that there's really a lot of interaction between various alien species and members of the military-industrial complex. And this interaction could be such that some of the elite are doing the bidding of certain species. And perhaps some of those species see fit to encode certain universal truths in architecture and urban design. Or perhaps they're doing it for nefarious purposes somehow. Some mechanism of harvesting our energies could be there. People have advanced theories like that.
Yeah.
So that's another whole can of worms, if you will, about going with the alien thread. It could be ancient aliens, which I expressed earlier, or it could be aliens among us today.
Yeah.
And I find both possibilities have a lot of explanatory power. And I think they're worth, each one of these is like a rabbit hole you can go down and explore and spend weeks or months plumbing the depths of that particular line of inquiry.
Yeah.
But I like to get back to the overview and look at the next type of encoders if we can.
Sure.
The encoders of the third kind are non-physical beings that interact with human beings. And these are known as angels and demons and gods and goddesses and astral beings. And this is where we get Isis and Osiris and Lucifer and we get the Archons, and we get all of these actors who interact with us in an unseen way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Dogon, this tribe in Mali, talks about their teachers who gave them all of this wisdom that they've faithfully preserved for thousands of years. And they talk about their teachers as spiritual beings who presumably didn't have a physical presence to them.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, they could hear them. And this is where we get all the mythology about, where the ancient Egyptians were in communion with the gods. And so we can explore these realms in dreams, in remote viewing, where we can transcend time and space, in entheogenic substances, we can explore these realms. And so there's a reality there as well that we can't deny. There's something to that. There is a metaphysics that goes beyond the physical. And there's a whole complexity there that is incredible. And it's really interesting to study how that these beings might be interacting with us. And I speculate that I'm being interacted with at times, because I inexplicably find a measurement. And I don't really measure very many things in Google Earth, believe it or not. But I feel a hunch that I should check something out. And I can't figure out where that's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel, okay, I want to measure the distance from Silbury Hill to the Shard.
Was that how it came to you, like that?
Yeah, just like that. Like, I really have this yearning to do that.
Yeah.
And it's very subtle, because I could ignore it. But I am sensitive in paying attention to those yearnings. So I measure it. But I don't just sit around measuring distances all day like some people might think.
And then it's random.
I measure very few things. Like the distance from the Dome of the Rock to Stonehenge is 33.33 degrees. Now, that's amazing.
Yeah.
The distance from the Kaaba in Mecca to the Dome of the Rock is 666 nautical miles. The distance from, I think, the Dome of the Rock to Baalbek, now I could be wrong about this, but I think that's 777 nautical miles, or maybe that was from the Great Pyramid, I can't recall. But anyway, I get these hunches or intuitions to check something out, and then I'm usually really pleased when it pans out, there's something to it. So I speculate that I have, like, a handler who's tasked with feeding me these things that is a non-physical being. But I don't hear voices in my head. I don't see visions.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a very, very subtle urge that I feel. And so I think that maybe there are architects, very well-known architects, who decide to build an 864-foot-high building in a certain location. based on that type of feeling. Yeah?
Yeah.
Not necessarily a full-blown conspiracy with meetings and other conspirators in a boardroom where they're smoking cigars and laughing about how they're controlling the world.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. Although that is also possible. So I like to put all of these cards on the table and then leave it up to you to decide in each situation what you think is the most plausible.
Yeah.
But I think there's value in this exploration of all these cards, you know, to see what are the possibilities.
Yeah.
And then the very last kind of encoder, the encoder of the fourth kind, ultimately is you, yourself. Because in Secrets in Plain Sight, it's mostly about it. It and them. But on a more spiritual or mystical journey, we can look, transform the it of the world into a relationship between us and them, and then we can transform that to a statement about myself. And so ultimately I think there is only one awareness that is responsible for everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I'm going with this fourth kind, where ultimately it's all within you. These shadow elements are your shadows. But it requires a skill to develop in the evolution of your being, of your separate self. It requires skills to develop, clairvoyance, clairaudience,
mm-hmm.
Remote viewing. These are skills that one can earn to allow you to see beyond the confines of your own separate mind.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I don't claim to have great, really well-developed skills there. I think I have earned certain skills there, as I said, where I feel that it's almost like there's a handler who's feeding me information. That is a skill that I've developed. Okay.
Yeah.
And that allows you to get information. And I think actually all discoveries come through that mechanism, through that intuition.
Yeah.
All scientific breakthroughs are flashes of insight.
That's right. Yeah.
They're not methodical, plodding, day-to-day, logical, rational thinking. They always come from this flash, this inspiration, this jump. Almost always. I should say there are also accidents that occur.
Well, exactly. They, you know, fiddled around with something and they, you know, they dropped the wrong thing into the other thing and look at the results. But yeah, no, you're right. Exactly. It's also that, you know, when you talked about the encoders of the third kind, that these are, you know, non-physical beings interacting with human beings through dreams, hallucinogenic substances or in other ways, you know, even your, how you are being influenced as you feel or get that hunch kind of thing, that could also, obviously, as you state here, be your higher self, that in some way you get that moment of connecting with yourself on another plane of existence, another realm, your higher self, and hence you know, you already know the answer, but you just had that moment of clarity of where to go to look for it.
Exactly, and I want to say also that these encoders of these four kinds are not all on the same level. You can think of each one as transcending and including the ones before it. So one could say that the encoder of the fourth kind, I am, is ultimately the agent behind everything. But that's kind of a one-liner, isn't it? Okay, we got that. Mm. But there's great complexity in the world. And perhaps down from that level, we have the hyperdimensional beings, which in turn influence the physical beings, but whether they are here on Earth or whether the physical beings are technologically more advanced and live on other planets and may have an occasion to visit us here.
Mm.
But those hyperdimensional beings could still influence the physical beings, you see?
Sure.
So there's this cascading hierarchy in a way, where there's a movement of it as consciousness expands, as you examine encoders of the first kind to encoders of the second kind to the third kind to the fourth kind. It's an expansion of awareness to higher possibilities.
Yeah.
Is what I'm trying to get at.
And then there is a feedback loop in that once you reach the fourth kind, then you really also at the same time then back to the first kind, where you have people sitting in, you know, boardrooms and conspiring, and they've gotten this hunch from a higher source, which might be themselves. You see what I mean?
Exactly. Yes. And so you could say divinity is transcendent from the world. It is nothing. It is not a thing, but it's also immanent in all things. All things are nothing but awareness. So what we have then is a dance. We are not only the dancers, but we're the dance and the dance floor. Okay? Mm. But what we need to do is enjoy that dance at all different levels. And I think all too often we're not enjoying it. It's turned into a nightmare. And I think that there can be a sense of liberation by exploring these different levels of consciousness all the way out to the highest level and then back again, sort of like Bilbo went there and back again in The Hobbit.
Yeah.
We want to come back and embody our awareness in the physical. That's our goal, right?
Yeah.
So it's not just getting away and seeing you're not that, but actually coming back and saying, I am that, and I'm responsible for it, and I own up to it.
Well, exactly. It takes something to bring it back into the real world as well, because, there are multiple levels to every aspect here, but there is another version where this serves as a kind of a, and I don't mean this in a negative way to everyone out there who's seeking, you know, spiritual enlightenment or whatever, not at all, but there is in some cases, there is another level of escapism there, that there is a kind of a disconnection from the world, and people want to, you know, escape, if you will, into not being here because their experiences have either been, you know, horrible or, you know, for other reasons, they just don't like it, you know. But I think, you know, just as you say, the most difficult thing is to be in the world, but maybe not of it, but at the same time having these different capacities of having multiple perspectives of who we are ourselves, having a contact with our higher self, and yet at the same time, some days you just want to be on the planet and you know, do something that's fun and you know, potentially in that sense meaningless if you look at it from a higher point of view. But nothing is, you know, nothing is. It's all good because it's our learning curve. This is what we do here.
Yeah, that's very well said, Henrik. And I think that's why I love the philosophy of non-duality. And I see it even something beyond philosophy, in that the idea of not two. So what are the two? The two are the physical world, the mundane world, that is, and the transcendent. And so that's about escapism oftentimes. It's about getting out of here. Right?
Yeah.
That's a necessary stage, though, to do that.
Sure.
And then it's almost like an evolution through this scientific materialism to Buddhism, say, where you look at the transcendent. But all religions actually have this component. But then what I like so much about non-duality is it brings it home again. Because not only are you transcendent, but you're also here and in everything. And I think that last step is what's missing so often. And that is, you come back again. Like in Zen, they say, in the first step is mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. That's the mundane consciousness. And then later, you transcend that and you realize mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers. They're nothing. Their awareness. And then finally you come home and you realize mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers.
Yeah.
But you have a different perspective on it.
Mm, yeah.
And I think so that's the whole hero's journey right there.
Yeah. Exactly.
You want to come back home with this newfound wisdom, and then you can let that inform your whole life. And so that has been my kind of, I've been put on this journey through Secrets in Plain Sight and Taking Measure. And I'm happy to share with you that homecoming feeling of, okay, there is no escape. There ultimately cannot be an escape. We are here, and we need to honor our physical existence in the best way we can, in the best way we can get along with other people. And I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. It's an amazing experience, and we get caught up in the drama, and sometimes that's a necessity for us to be able to take it, make it so that it's real to us, so that we don't, when we participate in the drama, that we do it well, we play the part well, if you know what I mean. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a good theater in that sense. We sometimes we need to be caught up in the heat of the moment, if you will, or the drama that plays out, only to maybe later zoom out and get that perspective on it. But I agree with that. I find it so fascinating that when you think that you've reached a certain point, let's say in your life, or a level, however you want to term that, that in some way you're drawn back to the basics again, and you realize that, wait a minute, I'm back where I kind of started, or where I was much earlier, but now I have a completely different awareness to it. I have a completely different way that I'm looking at it. And for the first time I see, this could be even second and third time around as well, but I see more and more as I passed through the same place, if you will, again, as I returned to the starting point, I just realized that I have so much, more with me that I can use to understand where I am and who, where I am and who I am. So it's fascinating.
That's very well said. And I think of that progression as a helix, like a DNA strand, where you come back around, but you're above the place you were before.
Yeah, exactly.
Still part of you. You've transcended it. That is, you've gone beyond it, but you've also included all of that experience in where you are now.
Yeah.
So you recognize, you say, hey, this looks familiar, Like, I can't believe that I came back to believing in gods and angels and demons and so on. But I do. But I say I can't believe that because I went through a whole period of atheism, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I come back around but I have a rationality to it now that I didn't have before. And so I can recognize patterns like, okay, it seems like I've been here before, but everything is a little bit different. Yeah. And so it's this wonderful, and that's why you can recognize that it is a dance that we're in. I've done this step before, but I'm now in a different part of the room.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a pattern that I recognize. And that's why these patterns, you see them in the macrocosm in the world, and it implies consciousness, because it's only consciousness that perceives patterns and creates patterns intentionally, right?
Yeah, it's that's what makes it real, if you will. That is the you have to have the observer in there for it to register, I guess, on some level of if it happened or not. I think that also is part of our role in this, that we are here as the witnesses, I guess, in a certain way, that if we are indeed a creation of the universe itself, and ultimately we are that, even if have been meddled with genetically or not. I mean, they didn't make the stuff; they just kind of put it together, in a lab or whatever, that a scientist would do it. So it doesn't mean that they're the creators of it. So we are still our base material that we're made from, it still comes from this universe, and I believe that it does so with the intention as well. And one of the reasons for that might be that we are participatory in the discovery of itself, a system that is becoming self-aware, and we are individuals, like individual brain cells, let's say, in a larger structure that is beginning to develop that level of self-awareness. That's what I think is going on.
I agree with you very much, and I think last time we spoke, I talked about Easter eggs and
yeah,
how
that's right.
We've laid them for ourselves You know, we've encoded these treasures, hoping that one day we'll stumble upon them. Hmm. And when I say we, I don't mean this physical body, but I mean in the distant past, perhaps. It could be any one of these encoders has laid this treasure for us to later rediscover and say, yes, I recognize that I've been here before. You know, it's like a signpost or something.
Yeah.
It means you're on the right track. It's a good feeling, yeah, when you recognize these things.
You know, I'm thinking a lot about history, and you know, I love history and prehistory specifically of what happened, how we developed as a human species, and all the different, you know, struggles that has been going on and everything. And you know, part in this is kind of that thing that you talked about Easter eggs of big keys and clues for us to find now at this time or even later, that reveals something about that past, that makes us understand what really happened. But do you think that we ever will know what really has transpired here, or can we just kind of go forward in this spiral motion and slowly kind of just get a realization of who we are, and this will be the process? Because I mean, otherwise, what are we talking about? We have to invent a time machine, right, to really know what happened and where we come from, right?
Well, in a way, I think one way of thinking of it is everything is recorded. Another way of thinking of it is that the universe is a computer simulation, and that our awareness is the computer. And so all of the things that have happened to you in your life, whether even if they happened to you alone in your interior, you were suffering, and you didn't tell anybody about it, all of that is known. All of that feeds in to the whole. Mm. So I don't think anything is wasted or lost. I think it's all part of that dance, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Would you agree with that, or do you think it?
No, I do. I do agree with that. I think there's nothing exactly. Well, nothing. No experiences. Is a waste in that regard, and or any life or anything like that. This is a there's much more going on as well that what we don't understand yet either, of how things transpire in the world, and how even the smallest change of one individual is affecting the whole. There's a, you know, that is the dance, as you talked about it. There's so many variables here, and although there are big synchronistic patterns going on that probably will play out and unfold anyway, It's the smaller details of how we're all kind of in this dance and making reality unfold in the way it does. And you know, maybe it's predestined. I don't know, but I think there is a reasoning behind, you know, why we are where we're at right now, and all the things that have transpired. I think nothing is of that is a waste. No, not at all.
Yeah, it's all good from this perspective that we're sharing right now.
Yeah.
But we can also descend into it's horribly wrong and we have to change it, and that's good too. I mean, that's an appropriate response for certain stimuli.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And you know, more action is required. But see, we can have all these different perspectives depending on how we look at it. So it's a joy to me to have this discussion with you and to explore the sort of metaphysics and philosophy and just the way we look at the world. I'm really impressed with how you conduct yourself, Henrik, and your open mind and your exploration and your pursuit of the truth. I really admire that.
Thank you, Scott. Yeah, I really appreciate that. Yeah, this has been a lot of fun for me too. It's always a joy having you on and talking with you and about your work and also just philosophizing like this and getting to the deeper levels of this kind of work, because, you know, what's contained in the book, all you do go there at the end of the, you know, at the last chapter on the encoders more in this veneer, it's still kind of, there is always so much more going on behind the scenes and behind the person who's writing that. And that's why this is so interesting. But before we begin to wrap things up for this time, though, Scott, I wanted to ask you, what are you up to right now? What are you working on some new stuff right now?
Yes. I just finished a Photoshop product, which will be called Photoshop for Architects, and I'm excited to publish that in the next couple of weeks, probably. And aside from that type of work, which is great for paying the bills, which is necessary, I'm really passionate about a novel that I'm writing. And I've really gone into outlining every scene in the novel and lots of detail in there. But now I'm happy to say that I'm going to sit down and actually crank it out. And I found that that's how it happened for me with Secrets in Plain Sight and writing the script. I had done a lot of thinking about it. And then when I wrote the script, it came out really quickly. And so I imagine the novel process will be like that as well. I've done all the hard work, really, of thinking about it in great detail. And now it's going to come out, and I'm really excited about that creative process, because it's going to use all of my talents to express things. I've never written fiction before. I've written many nonfiction books. Taking Measure is obviously a nonfiction, and I've written many other computer books, you know, which is my professional side.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to dive into the world of fiction, because I think fiction is a wonderful vehicle for explaining complex things in a way that's compelling, that doesn't seem like you're going to school or something. At least I'm going to create this book as an intellectual thriller, so you're going to want to turn the page and you're going to want to find out what happens. And I'm weaving in many different threads into this. One of them is it follows the conscious evolution of a quantum computer and how that influences the lives of the people around it. And other threads include intrigue with the NSA, and all of this stuff that's come out with the NSA lately has really just incredible good timing for me, because I've been thinking about the NSA for a long time. Mm. I'm just like, wow, I wish I had the novel ready right now. because all this stuff is breaking.
Yeah.
But it's also about breaking internet encryption and secret societies. It will be a treasure hunt of sorts, and it will include concepts of zero-point energy and exploration of non-duality. So it's weaving together my personal journey through Secrets in Plain Sight and Taking Measure, and I'm fictionalizing that so that it will be a really compelling and hopefully a really exciting read for people to explore.
Interesting. So do you know if you're going to self-publish or try to get a publisher? Or?
Well, I think my inclination is to self-publish, but I'm open to the possibility of going through a publishing house. It just depends on what they bring to the table. You know, the publishing industry is really transforming, and I'm starting to wonder what they are bringing to the table.
I know.
Because, I published Taking Measure myself, and the physical copy of the book is indistinguishable from a book that's published by a publisher.
Yeah.
And it's on Amazon, and that's what a publisher would do for me. But I think the publishers actually do have some connections with bookstores.
Yeah,
and,
a little marketing maybe, but yeah, I wonder how much these
days.
Yeah.
So it depends on how much of the pie I want to cut up and give away to them.
Yeah.
But there is a good case for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's really exciting, Scott. And so you're going to work on that now. And so later, obviously, we'll stay in contact, of course, and talk more about that. But are you going to put it up on your Secrets in Plain Sight website or scottonstar.com?
It will definitely be on both sites when it does come out. And I can also say that I'm in discussion with two different groups in creating a television series. And this has been something that's been ongoing for some time. It's sort of heated up a year ago, and then it cooled off, and now it's heating up again. So there's a possibility that you might see something on television, which would be great, in that it would reach out to more people.
Sure, interesting. More mainstream TV or alternative?
I'm not sure.
We'll see where it goes.
You know, we just have to let the people in the business decide.
Sure.
Where they see it the best place for it.
Very good.
But I think more and more people are tuning into these sort of things. There's a few million people who've watched Secrets in Plain Sight on YouTube.
Yeah, like 3.5, I think,
That. You know, it's great. It's been copied by other people, and they put their name on it, which isn't really, you know, respecting me. But since I did put it on YouTube, I'll let that slide because it is allowing more people to see it in different places on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's hard to calculate exactly how many, but there's a lot of people interested, so I'm encouraged.
Oh, exactly. Sure, exactly. And there's a lot of, you know, folks connecting with you, I think, consequently, after they've seen your work, and they you know, search on the title and your name and everything. So it's all good exposure, I think, at the end of the day anyway. And speaking about novels, I just want to mention this as well. There's a lot of, you know, more esoteric and alternative researchers and such that are going down that road as well. We had Graham Hancock with us here just a few days ago here now, talking about he did Entangled previously, and now he's coming out with War God, which we talked about when he was with us.
Oh, that's great. I read Entangled. That was excellent. And I just bought War God on the Kindle, and I'm looking forward to reading that. Yeah, he's an inspiration. You know, he's sort of is similar to me in that he's written all these nonfiction books, and now he's branching out into fiction.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, I'm following in his footsteps in that regard.
Well, there are good footsteps to follow, and Graham is great, does great work, and he and Rob Duvall and all the other co-authors that they're hooking up with there, so good stuff. All right, well, Scott, why don't we wrap things up for this time then? Please give us the websites one more time here, so none is left out and confused about where to go or not to go and stuff like that. So, and give us the title of the book, and you have it in both in PDF, EPUB version, and also you do have a hard copy as well, correct?
That's right. It the book is called Taking Measure: Explorations in Number Architecture and Consciousness, and it's available at secretsinplainsight.com, both in EPUB, which is you can use EPUBs on most readers, and also in the physical copy that's published through CreateSpace, which is owned by Amazon. So when you order a copy, it's amazing. They just print one out and send it to you right away, and I'm just amazed by that technology, you know.
Yeah.
That they're able to do that, but it works very well. The book is a quality physical thing, and hopefully you like the content as well.
Oh, you will. Have you been listening here today and enjoying it? You definitely will. There's a lot of good stuff in the book, and a lot of stuff that we didn't talk about here. Of course, it's 9 chapters. Do check it out. Very excellent stuff. Secretsinplainsight.com. Go there. Thank you so much, Scott. Keep up the good work, and have a creative blast with the novel. Looking forward to that as well.
Thanks very much, Henrik.
We'll proceed with Suzanne Posel next from Occupy Corporatism. Later, David Icke, Charles Eisenstein, and others are coming on. Take it easy, be well, and we'll speak to you again in just a few days. Thank you for listening, for your interest, and for your membership. Talk to you soon.